3 made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4 made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5 admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6 were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7 humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8 made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9 made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10 continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11 sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12 having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Mike. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. All our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA's statements of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask all of our speakers to identify by first name only and refrain from using profanity. Tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Virginia.
Hi, my name is Virginia. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 29th of 2016. So this will actually be my second real birthday because it's a leap year. So I'm really excited. I'll be sober for 8 years and at the end of February. I just moved to Boston about 6 months ago. And I started when I moved to going to Back Bay meetings, but then when it got cold and dark, I needed to start going to meetings in Brookline, which is where I live. So I've recently made this my home group, so I'm a little bit newer here, so I don't know a lot of you. So I'm here tonight to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was exposed to alcoholism at a very young age. One of my first memories, my father was an alcoholic, and one of my first memories was like walking through the door and seeing my dad holding a beer and just like starting to like scream, cry. Throughout my adolescence and early childhood, I thought that my dad loved or didn't love me enough. That's why he kept drinking and getting arrested and, you know, getting violent with my mom. I would do things like hide his keys and, you know, we'd get in a fight and it was just, there were holes in the wall around their house. You know, it's just like, just the chaos I grew up in. I swore I would never drink until 8th grade after homecoming party. Around that time, all my friends started drinking and I started to, think about what it would be like to drink. And then I got my first chance. My mom let me go with my older brother to the high school, after party. And, I remember there was warm natural light in all the cups. We were playing beer pong in the field in South Georgia, which is where I'm from. And I took my first drink and it tasted terribly. It was awful. And I remember being like, almost like, oh my gosh, I'm going to throw up. How do people do this? But then about a minute later, just the warmth and confidence and just, I mean, I felt like I could do anything. Like growing up, I, you know, grew to be 5'10". In like sixth grade, and I've always been very tall and awkward, and the boys always tease me because I was so much taller than them. I remember I had, and this was about the time I started to get a little boy crazy, so I was like, I had so much confidence to go up and talk to people. Like, I was dancing. I mean, I, like Bill said, like, I had arrived, you know. And I remember telling my friend that night, I was like, we've got to do this every weekend from then on out. And just since that first drink, you know, I just chased alcohol and chased that feeling as often as I could. I had all that structure in high school. I was an athlete, so I was, you know, very busy. I was a good student, so I had a lot of structure, and my mom was pretty strict on me. So, you know, things didn't really get out of control for me until college. But in high school, I did, when I drank, I frequently blacked out, you know, and I would drive my car, but I really didn't have any consequences. And I genuinely felt like I was doing what everyone around me was doing. Until college. College, things started to get a little out of control. I didn't, you know, I was blacking out more often. And slowly, it started to get worse and worse. Like, I would wake up and I had wet the bed, and that was, like, horrifying. Or I would wake up and I'd vomited all over my $2,000 laptop. Or I would wake up and, like, my car was just gone. To the point where I literally almost filed a police report because I thought my car was stolen, but it was on the top deck of my parking garage, like parked like horizontally in a vertical spot. Like, that happened 3 times. Not the car wasn't always in the same spot. One time it was at a drug dealer's house, the next time, you know, it was just all over the place. But the point is, when I, and I would vow to myself, Virginia, just cut back next time, you know, just don't drink as much. You know, you can still have fun with everybody, just like, but once that drink got into my system, I lost all control. And you can imagine what happened from there. Consequences starting to build up. I started to hate myself so much that I started to become suicidal. So I went to a therapist's office at the Student Health Center at the University of Georgia, and I showed up reeking of alcohol from the night before, you know, on some other stuff. And she immediately was like, you should go to this place. And it was called the Athens Area Commencement Center. And it was actually rehab. I didn't know that at the time. But I went there and they were like, yep, you need to be here. So I stayed there. And you know, I was exposed to AA. And I remember walking to my first young people's meeting and seeing everyone laugh and smile. And I remember I called my mom after and I was like, these people had this light in their eyes. And they just had this like happiness oozing from them. And I was like, I want what they have. But at that time I wasn't ready to give up alcohol. And I was only an addict in treatment. I was not an alcoholic. So I was 21, you know, I was like not ready to give up drinking. Cause what was I going to do? How was I going to have fun? Drinking wasn't fun anymore though. So I left treatment, and here's how insidious alcoholism is. On the way home from treatment, I convinced my roommates I wasn't an alcoholic. I bought a bottle of wine on the way home to celebrate being done with rehab. I put the bottle of wine, I bought 2 bottles of wine, put one in the trunk of my car, took one inside. I'd gotten a big styrofoam cup at the gas station of soda, which I filled with wine, pretending like it was soda to my roommates. So I filled that up, went inside, had a glass with them, but kept going outside to refill up the styrofoam bottle and all the things they taught me in treatment about the red flags for alcoholism. And I still was not an alcoholic. And I drank for like 6 more months, almost a year. And that led to an overdose, a suicide attempt. And, you know, that still wasn't enough to get me sober. And I finally one day was just like, I've had enough, you know, and I came back to AA because I felt the solution when I was in here. And I wanted what those people had. I wanted that contentness, that happiness, and I knew that there was a way out because I'd heard it. So I came in and I worked the steps, and, you know, the first couple of times I picked up 1 million white chips in like 6 months because I was not willing to change people, places, and things. And I still tried to date the guy who was still drink, my college boyfriend who kept, you know, drinking around me. And I was powerless, you know, because I hadn't had a spiritual experience from the steps yet. But once I finally got a sponsor, finally started working the steps, you know, step 3 was the big one. Willingness, like being totally willing to turn my life over to my higher power. And you know, once I finally became willing to do that, like, and work the rest of the steps with a sponsor, the 10th step promises really came true. I remember I was walking down, I was helping a girl in my apartment complex walk her dog. And I walk in to her room and I saw some substances on the table and I saw alcohol, open alcohol. Now, I'm someone who used to steal anything and everything. Like, my roommate's alcohol, gone. You know, if I saw it laying out, it was fair game. But I walked into that room, and I had this peace come over me. And no one would have ever known. I could have drinking the alcohol. I could have done whatever with the other stuff. But I had this, like, peace that I was not fighting it, nor was I, like I was recoiling like a hot flame, like the tense that promises. And I'd never experienced that before. I'd never been in alone with a room with alcohol and other substances since this journey began. And I said no. And that's when I knew that this program was something special. And since I've, you know, continued to walk this journey, I've gotten everything I've ever wanted out of life. You know, I was able to go back to school. Now I have the career of my dreams. I was able to get myself to a healthy enough place where I could attract a partner that and a husband who's just like the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I have beautiful friendships today with women that I've moved. It's my third time moving in sobriety. And I've just met lifelong friends along the way. You know, and my problems today are problems of perception, you know, because nothing was ever as bad as it was that morning of my last drink when I was combing through this poor man who decided to date me at that time, pouring through his apartment, scounding, picking up things out of the carpet and, you know, trying to use them, like chugging like the like empty bottles on the table, like that desperation, like nothing is as bad as that, you know? And if I remind myself that, I can be really happy today. So that's all I have. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Virginia. We will now observe the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. We are passing the basket, and you may also observe the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. There is a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. Although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, we do have expenses. Our rent is $200 per month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Megan, with any questions. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Sam has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Sweet. Hey, I'm Sam. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, cool. Looks like. Thank you, Amanda. All right, the 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thanks.
Thanks, Sam. And now let's welcome our 10-minute speaker, Neil.
Hi, I'm Neil. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 16th, 2023, so I have just over 7 months. I have a sponsor. Nose is my sponsor. I've been through the steps. I continue to work them. I have a home group, yada, yada, yada. So this is not my first stint in AA. This is certainly not my first time trying to get sober. But, you know, from the beginning, I came from an alcoholic family. My dad used to crush up Valium and put it in my milk as a baby to make me go to sleep. One of my first memories was in an apartment in East Boston stealing pina coladas from my parents. One of my second memories was when we moved to North Reading at a family party stealing sips of my dad's Heineken. So I've had substances in me from a young age. I've been around alcoholism from a young age. And it was... inside the home was very chaotic, but my mother, who is to this day an alcoholic in denial, has always portrayed us as a perfect, loving, you know, middle-class family on the outside. And that really caused a lot of problems for me as a kid because I didn't know how to express the problems that I was going through and felt like I had to portray that image of, you know, we're a perfect family. You know, my dad always knew what he was. But he lived a crazy life, and he was going to be what he wanted to be and do what he wanted to do. I lost him to this disease 2 years ago. You know, it's been hard trying to get over that and accept that I couldn't change him. And, you know, he was going to do what he was going to do. But I had my first drink at about 11 at a family party, stealing alcohol with my cousins from all the aunts and uncles. And I didn't like it, but... about a couple years later, I was at a party with some friends, and I tried it again, and I absolutely fell in love with it. Because as a kid, I had all these... I never thought I was good enough. You know, no matter what I did, whether it was being an athlete, a student, a friend, talking to girls, you know, trying to be funny, I always saw somebody or multiple people better than everything I tried to do. And then at that party, I drank, I got drunk, and all those fears and insecurities went away. I was the life of the party. And, you know, from then on out through my high school career, that's basically how it went. I had a lot of fun, not going to lie. For a long time, I was a high-functioning alcoholic. I went to college, I got a degree, I played sports. You know, I was a good student. I could hold a job, I could save money. And then I met the girl of my dreams in college. You know, we were together on and off for 5 years. We ended up getting engaged, bought a house. We were talking about having kids, planning a wedding. Actually, I have to backtrack. So before, about the middle of the relationship, I got the job of my dreams with the Red Sox. But this was the first time I realized I had a problem because at the end of the season, I was not invited back. I wasn't fired, but I wasn't invited back because that whole time is when it got really bad for me, and I started stealing from the players, stealing merchandise from the team. I was showing up late. I was off in the locker room hiding during the game when no one was around, drinking and getting high. And so when I lost that, that was the first time I realized I had a problem, but I wasn't going to do anything about it. I just thought I had to manage it better. So then, you know, went back to my girlfriend down in Florida, and, after about another year and a half, she told me to get out for the final time because what it boiled down to was I couldn't be the man she needed because of my alcoholism. And that pretty much just broke me. From then on, it got worse and worse. I never had jackpots until after this point. I always got away with things. I could talk my way out of everything. Cops, it didn't matter what it was, I could get out of it. My dad always said I had a horseshoe up my ass, and I never know how that made you lucky, but that's apparently a term for being lucky, and I did. So yeah, the consequences started to pile up. I started getting arrested. I was completely engulfed in self-pity, self-hatred, self-destruction. You know, I didn't care whether I lived or died, I just wanted to be numb at that point. So the first time I went to rehab was in end of 2020. For a long time, realizing now that I had a problem, I tried to get sober on my own. You know, I thought, my dad always raised me to be like this, you know, self-made, self-will, do everything yourself, tough guy. And I thought I was. I thought I could, you know, just get the substances out of me and I'd be good. And then, you know, I'd go through detox and a few days later I'd take a drink and then I'd, you know, do some other stuff and be off and running again. And I couldn't figure out why. And that, you know, that cycle continued. And then finally, a couple years later, I went to rehab and I learned a lot about, you know, the science of this disease and, that it is a disease. You know, it takes more than just self-will and, you know, to really stay sober. When I got out, I called my cousin who had, about 7 years sober at the time. And I asked him to be my sponsor. And he was like, you know, I'd love to, but we're family. I don't want to be biased, so let me hook you up with someone. And the guy he hooked me up with is still my sponsor to this day. But at the time, there were no meetings going on. I tried a couple Zoom meetings. I just wasn't feeling it. But I was going over to the sober house that he managed, and, you know, he was bringing me through the book. But basically, I was like, I don't really care how powerless I am. I'm not doing all this. Like, you know, fearless moral inventory. I was like, no, thank you. Amends and cleaning my side of the street. I was like, let's start with your side of the street. And then I didn't even know what inventory was, and I didn't want to know. So, yeah, I really just was not willing at all. You know, I went back out. About 8 months later, I ended up in rehab for, you know, the third time that year. And I finally called my sponsor, and I was like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I don't care what the hell it is I got to do. Just tell me and I'll do it. And he was like, you know, stay for the 30 days. And then when you're getting ready to get out, call me. So when I called him when I was getting ready to get out, he was like, you can't go home. My dad had always been my running partner ever since I was like 15, 16. And like I said, my mom's an alcoholic in denial. So he was like, you know what happens when you go home? Like, you can't. You got to go to a house. You got to go to aftercare. So I found a halfway house. I went there. You know, it was a working house, but it was like very AA based. We had to go to meetings every day. I had to have a sponsor, so I started working, going through the book again with him. And everything, like, I saw the benefits of this program. You know, my life started getting better. I started making friends. You know, just, I've always believed in God, but I'd always said, I don't need you, and I always had a resentment against God. But now I was really trying to build a relationship with my higher power, and I saw the benefits of that. But again, I really wasn't willing. I didn't know how to totally give over my will to my higher power. You know, I was working the steps, but I certainly wasn't living them. And, I was going to AA every day, but I was going selfishly. I was doing service because it looked good. And, you know, I was very, very worried about what other people thought of me at the time still. Trying to appease, you know, my family, my friends. I thought I was doing the right thing, but I really wasn't. So about 4 months later, I got kicked out of the house. It was a weird situation, but, not drugs and alcohol related, but I got kicked out and, I just stopped doing everything I was doing. You know, not calling my sponsor, no step work, no AA meetings. I went back to I had an apartment in Burlington at the time, and I was just hiding out there. I was seeing a girl, and, you know, we were together pretty much every other day, and that was toxic as hell. And then 3 weeks later, my dad died. You know, he was drinking one night, and he fell down the stairs, and EMTs came. He wouldn't go to the hospital, and he never woke up. And I completely just let it break me. I went right back out. I went out as hard as I possibly could. I moved back home to take care of my mom, or try to, which was a struggle because I couldn't even take care of myself. And, I'm sorry. Okay, I can talk, sorry. Let me get to, so it was a year and a half of hell, and then I got arrested. I went to jail, but when I went to jail, it was a relief because that whole year and a half, like I knew I couldn't stop. And getting arrested allowed me to stop, allowed me to, you know, focus on whatever I had to do to get my life back on track. These last 7 months have been probably the most difficult time in my life, but without a doubt, the best time in my life. Like I said, I've been through the steps. I just moved out of the sober house that I was living in, which was, it completely changed my life because it's a 12-step house, and you know, it's very structured and it's exactly what I needed. But now I still live with sober people. I'm right down the street. I'm still involved in the house. I take guys through the book. I'm heavily, heavily involved in AA. I'm a part of MISCIPA, which is the Massachusetts State Conference of Young People in AA. You know, this type of life is something that I can't see me living without. The people that I've met, the things that I do, the places I go, everything is basically falling into place for me at this point. And that's all due to this program, my higher power. And I wouldn't change a thing for the world. Thanks.
Thanks, Neil. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator, Ramiro, after the meeting. And now let's welcome our main speaker, Andrea.
Hi, everyone. My name's Andrea Kay, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Andrea.
I'm extremely grateful to be here tonight. Thank you, Amanda, for asking me to speak. And my sobriety date is May 4th, 2013. I'm really grateful to have a sobriety date, too. I'm actually really grateful for this meeting. This meeting is a pivotal reason why I'm actually here and have learned the program the way that I've learned it. I don't think I would have ever been sober today if I didn't come across the people in this meeting and the way that this meeting has been able to bring recovery into my life, the solution with the steps. I started going to AA really young. I live north of Boston, and the AA where I come from, they talk about just going to meetings and just not drinking. And for me, I couldn't just go to a meeting and just not drink. I didn't know if there was something wrong with me, why I couldn't get this. And I realized by God doing for me what I could not do for myself that by the time that I was able to find a meeting in the Brooklyn area, which was BYP first, that led me to the door to this one, that I was misinformed by the misinformed and that there was a solution, that there was a way out. And for me, I never thought that that was going to be the case. I never thought that that was possible. I had started really young. I come from a lot of alcoholism, mental illness, addiction. It runs deep on both sides of my family. I have seen and lost a lot of family and friends die from this disease. And as far as I can remember, you know, this disease was rampant in my own life. I started really young, like around 10 or 11 years old, and I couldn't wait to drink. And I saw my parents drink. They would party all the time. They worked really hard, and it was like a way of life, and I wanted what they had, and I wanted to do what they did, and I couldn't wait to grow up and do that. And I didn't actually wait till I grew up. I just started one day when I was 11. I found an absolute bottle of vodka sitting by itself, and I thought, oh, it might be a good idea to just pick that up and start chugging it. No one taught me that. That's what I did, and it burned going down, but the effect was unbelievable. It all the stuff that had happened to me as a young kid, trauma, abuse, all of it, it just shut it all off. It like helped me feel like I could be okay in my own skin. It really just took all that pain away. I had a lot of stuff happen to me growing up, and you know, it fixed it for me. And I also had a lot of social anxiety. I wasn't really okay around, you know, being around people. I didn't have, I wasn't easily able to make friends. Sunday nights before going to school, like on Monday morning, it was big bouts of anxiety where I would like be crying and like begging my mom not to make me go to school. And I just always had like this impending pit in my stomach. And alcohol took that away from me. It really just helped all of the things. I also suffered with a lot of depression at an early age. I had suicidal ideation, and I had a lot of diagnoses from the get-go that, you know, my parents tried everything they could to help me with. I've been diagnosed with depression, anxiety, ADD. I had learning disabilities, bipolar, borderline personality disorder, I was told, like just all these things. And my parents did the best they could to help me get the help that I needed. And I started in therapy really young. And, you know, I really thought that maybe I could find an answer in therapy. And they really started in giving me all these different psych meds and all this other stuff. And nothing worked like alcohol and drugs. And I chased that. And so, like I said, I started really young, and it was a way of life really early on. And I, by the time that I was a freshman in high school, it was the only way that I could cope. And I would start drinking before my school day in order to get through the day. And I had a lot of consequences happen really early in my drinking career. And by the time that I was 15, my parents were threatening to take my solution away. I was told that I was going to have a chins put on me, and I was in trouble with the court systems, and I was getting expelled and suspended. I mean, I got suspended and then it turned into expulsion at school. And my mom had my principal's phone number, and my principal had my mom's cell phone on speed dial. And it was just insane how everything was just revolved around alcohol at that time. And my parents were fighting a lot, and they didn't know how to help me. And I wanted to be good. Like, I wanted to actually not be in that much trouble all the time. And I didn't want to cause all those problems. And I hated myself so much. And I thought that it was a moral issue. And the thing is that by the time that they were threatening to put this chins on me and have me drug tested on a regular basis, I felt like if you had my life, you would drink and drug the way that I did too. And if you're going to take that away from me, then I don't want to live. And so my first suicide attempt was at the age of 15. I ended up in a coma for 3 days, and my parents were absolutely horrified that their 15-year-old girl thought that life was that bad then, that she would want to kill herself. And again, that opened the door to trying to get more help with the mental illness side of things, and then also substance abuse stuff. And so I ended up in dual diagnosis programs, and I got introduced to AA for the first time at 15. And the man that I heard speak for the first time was an older white man, maybe mid-30s, but I was only 15, and he was talking about getting a DUI. He was talking about losing his kids. He was talking about losing his job. And at 15, I could not identify. I just compared myself right out of AA, you know, and I just really didn't hear anything that he could say that was helpful to me. I was having a lot of fun drinking, but the consequences weren't fun. And at that time, I didn't want to stop, but my family needed me to stop. And so I would do all the things that they asked me to do, but I wasn't really ready on any level. It took me a long time. So to fast forward 15 more years, at least, I got sober around 31 finally, but I had tried. This is the disease of progression. And I can't tell you that stories that, like, I was just filling you in on, like, that was actually the worst of it, because it wasn't. It got really bad, and it looked okay for a while I worked in kitchens. I was you know, I worked as a pastry cook, and I lived in the lifestyle, and I was able to now be, you know, older than 18, so I didn't have to answer to my parents as much, and I could keep it at bay a little bit. But really what was happening was this pattern of me going in and out of psych wards in order to not kill myself. And alcohol really would help me a lot from those lonely times when I really did just want to die. And I was really codependent on people too. And I had a lot of baggage and a lot of stuff. And I would surround myself with people that you wouldn't want your worst enemy to really be hanging out with, or someone that you cared about and loved. You wouldn't want them to be around doing the things that I was doing and getting the things that I needed in order to be okay. And by this time, my mid-20s, I'm waking up crying because I'm waking up. And it's just so painful. And I really just, I couldn't even look at myself in the mirror. Like, it was just so, I was so disgusted with myself, and it was so dark. And I wanted to be sober at this point. I really did. And so I was, my parents had they wanted me to sign paperwork to become my guardians. At 25 years old, they wanted to have full guardianship over me because they could not trust the decisions that I was making, and I wasn't doing well, and I was had been in and out of sober houses, in and out of treatment centers, residential programs at McLean's Hospital, like all over New Hampshire and Massachusetts with all of these recovery centers. And nothing seemed to really help me be able to stay sober. And I, like I told you, I thought I had tried AA, and I didn't think that AA could be the answer. And I really, really did not believe in God. At 15, when I had tried to kill myself, that was the point where I turned my back on God fully, because I thought that if there was a God, he clearly didn't love me and he wasn't showing up for me. And I don't know why all that stuff had to happen to me when I was a kid. I got molested and whatever, all these other things that had happened. And I would pray. I would pray for God to help me. And I just felt like he never came. And I really thought that, like, there was no God. And that, and so, you know, AA spoke of God, and I wanted nothing to do with that. I actually thought you guys were a cult, and it was really, really painful to not have a way out and think that I had to keep living this way that I didn't really want to live anymore. And so the alternative, I thought, was like, if it ever really, I always told myself, if it ever really got that bad, like, I always could kill myself. Like, that was always it gave me like a chance to breathe. Like, if I had that, like, knowing that if things ever got that bad. And so, I'll just say that the first time that I ended up at McLean's Hospital, it was really helpful to learn a little bit more about alcoholism. But how I learned about that was not really through them, but because they really pushed going to AA and getting a sponsor. And so one of the many times at the residential program that I was at McLean's, this counselor, his name was Miles, and he told me that not all AA meetings are the same. And I thought he was crazy, but, you know, I was in this residential program, and what that looked like was that you would go to the groups throughout the day, and then at night you had to go to a 12-step program, and they didn't care which one. And then you would come back, and they would breathalyze you, and then you would either get to stay if you passed the breathalyzer, or they would kick you out. And I had no place to live at this point. This was the last chance that I had of having, you know, shelter, and so without being in a homeless shelter. And so I, you know, was trying to do what this guy suggested, and I didn't want to get kicked out. And he told me about a meeting on Saturday night, Brookline Young People, and I ended up going there, and I couldn't believe what I saw. It was a bunch of young, happy, sober people, you know, that were like really loving life. And I was petrified. Like, I was absolutely horrified by the fact that all these people were really that happy and sober, and I thought they were lying. I really did. I didn't think that they knew what it was really like to have, you know, the drinking problem that I had. I thought I was different. I didn't think that I was like them. And but because of this residential program and needing to have this slip signed and making sure that I was doing all the things, I sat through the meeting, and they end up calling random people to go up to the podium after the speaker. And so they look for the new person on purpose. And it saved my life. It was literally God doing for me what I could not do for myself. And I can just tell you that I got called up there, and I don't know how it happened, but I ended up with my eyes wide open, not being able to see. Everything was so blurry. I was like petrified, like shaking. And I ended up getting up to the podium, and I ended up saying, "My name is Andrea. I'm an alcoholic. I can't stop relapsing, and I want to die." And I ended up sitting back down. And during the break, all of these women came up to me, and I was not friends. I did not have friends that were female. You know, I was friends with the guys. I was a tomboy. I, you know, felt more comfortable around the guys. I liked the music that they liked. I played polka, played pool, whatever. You know, they were more fun. And the girls, I wanted nothing to do with. And so all these girls came up to me, and they were giving me their phone numbers, and I thought I was in hell. And it was just, it was horrifying, you know? And all I can say that there was this one woman who was practicing her 12-step, and because she was practicing her 12-step, I got to have a first-step experience. And this person had a message of weight and depth, and she, for whatever reason, was able to break through my shell and be able to talk to me in a way that I had never heard anyone talk to me before. And she was talking about how she had 5 years now and how she had known what it was like to come from where I come from, and now to have the solution change her life. And she was talking about the 12 steps out of the big book. And I really don't know if I had ever heard about that beforehand, but it felt like it was the first time ever of hearing about this message. And I did not know that it existed. And like I was saying, like, I had no idea that AA could be the way that I have found it to be today. And she offered her phone number, and I told her that I'm probably not going to call you. And she took mine, and I couldn't believe that I gave her the right number. And she did call me, and for whatever reason, I ended up answering. And I met her in 2011, and I didn't get sober till 2013. And this woman didn't shut the door on me, but she didn't coddle me, and she was always there to tell me the truth about the disease of alcoholism. And she was there to tell me and raise the bar up, and believe that I could do things that I never thought that I was going to be able to do sober. And she started to plant these seeds of recovery and of the 12 steps and talking about the doctor's opinion and teaching me about this disease. And I was blown away, because it was the first time that I had ever felt like maybe there was hope, you know, like I just really didn't think that there was going to be an answer for someone like me. And I just thought that, you know, it like started to crack the door of like, maybe I don't really know everything, you know? And like I said, it was 2011, and so it took me a long time. Like, I kept relapsing, and she kept telling me the truth. She kept saying, because I used to call her crying, and I was in so much pain. Thank you. I was in so much pain, and I would call her, and I would be telling her that, I know this works for you, but I'm different. I this is not going to work for me. And she was like, Andrea, you're picking and choosing certain things about this program that you're willing to do, but you're not doing all of it. And you can't tell me that this isn't going to work for you unless you do all of the program. And she says, because you're telling me that you identify as the real alcoholic. And so what that looks like is doing all 12 steps. And you've been maybe coming to the home group that you've signed up to do a service position for. You've been slacking on your 4-step. You know, you're not calling other women. Like, she had me wanting to call women, three women a day. She wanted me praying, right? And that was something that I didn't want to do. And so there was a lot of stuff that she was calling me out on that I wasn't doing. And I just thought she was crazy for a really long time, but there was something to what she was saying. And so slowly but surely, every time I relapsed and I would come to her and I would tell her what happened, she would tell me, well, because you haven't finished your 4-step. You haven't done this. You haven't done that. And I just didn't think that this was ever going to work, you know? And she told me to get on my knees and start praying for the willingness to beg God to help me be willing, because I wasn't willing and I didn't know how to be. And I really, really did want to be sober. Like, that was the thing. I just couldn't differentiate the truth from the false. I was completely dishonest with myself and with everyone else that it was just a way of life for me. And I really thought I was doing my 100%, but because she was able to, because I had a sponsor that was hands-on, that knew my story, that worked with me from start to finish with the steps, like really did a thorough fifth step with me. Like, she knew a lot about where I came from, and she was able to pull the wool, like pull the wool over my eyes every single time, which I really needed someone like that, you know? You know, I'll just tell you that on May 4th, 2013 is my sobriety date, and I called her up and I told her that I have a plan to kill myself. I said that this isn't going to work, that I have tried now everything that you said. And she says, Andrea, you can't just try it for a month. You can't just try this for a couple of weeks. You need to give this 1 year. And she was like, until you do that, then you can tell me that AA doesn't work for you, and you need to do all of it. You have no, you can't have any, you can't You can't have any defense against what I ask you to do. You can't, you know, you just need to have no questions. You just need to be willing to completely do it. And, you know, like another previous speaker was talking about the third step. Like, that was when I did a real thorough third step without even realizing it. Like, I was all in at this point because I told her that I know this isn't going to work for me. And I'll do it for 1 year. And I will do everything that you say. And I will do everything that the book, the way it's laid out. And I know that I'm different. I know that this won't work. And I'll prove it to you. And then after that, I will be able to look my parents in the eye and tell them when I, you know, go to a place where they can't find me this time, when I try to kill myself, because I'm going to make it happen, that I had done everything I could. And so she said, great. She said, let's keep you going, moving forward. And so I'll tell you, within 3 months of doing everything that she had asked me to do, like, I had moments in my own skin sober where I started to feel like I couldn't even believe that I was okay. Like, I couldn't even believe that I was actually feeling at peace in small time, like small moments. Like, it didn't happen overnight. I wasn't like, you know, all of a sudden elevating. Like, it really took a long time, but 3 months in the grand scheme of things, of 20 plus years of drinking and living the way I was living, like, to have moments where I knew that I was okay and I didn't feel like I needed to drink or drug or actually kill myself was mind-blowing to me. And I couldn't even believe that this program worked the way it did. And so from there, I ended up continuing to work this program to the best of my ability and continuing on to make this a way of life for the rest of my life. Like, that's what I do today. Like, this is a game changer for me. And it has helped me with everything in my life. Like, people in AA have shown up for me and I have shown up for them. And I never thought that these relationships were possible. I never thought that I'd be able to have a higher power, who I do call God today, which I never thought I would be able to do, who would help solve all my problems, not just my drink problem, like all my problems. And, you know, since I worked with her, I've ended up having another sponsor that's helped me grow to the next level. She helped me to a certain point, and then she wasn't really capable of giving me much more. I kind of outgrew her, and I had, you know, I had met another woman through her. That was my grand sponsor, and she's the person that started this meeting, and she has also helped change my life in so many different ways that I will never ever be able to repay what AA has given to me. Like, there is something here. Like, it's like something that you don't want to miss. Like, it has given me the ability to go back to school in sobriety in my mid-30s. Like, I'll just tell you, like, nothing is more humbling than going back to art. Like, I went to art school in my mid-30s with a bunch of 18-year-olds, like, at 35 or 36 years old. And, you know, like, I would never have been able to do that if it wasn't for this program. Like, that's 100%. And the reason why I had to go find a new career was because I had, in sobriety, a lot of physical pain working in the industry, in the restaurant world, the way that I was working it. I had hypomobility diagnosis and whatever else, you know, all these, you know, structural issues. And I couldn't continue to work in the industry that I was working. And so, like, I had to change my whole career. And I used to be, you know, I used to love my job. I used to love decorating cakes. I used to make wedding cakes and help people celebrate their special moments in their lives. Like, that was something that I loved to do. And I had to give that up. And then, but it's not even like, it was like, the new perspective change that the steps have given me is like, okay, like, the 11th step has been able to help answer, like, all of the problems that I have. Like, when I go to God and I literally ask him to show me where I need to be, it doesn't just get disclosed to me overnight, but, like, in time, it's really clear, like, on the path that I get to go on, you know? And, like, with that career change, like, I ended up getting a full scholarship, which I was expelled. I had learning disabilities. Like, there was no way that I was, like, ever going to be, like, a good student, you know? And, like, I ended up getting the president's award, $60,000 to be able to get a bachelor's degree. Like, for me, that's huge because no one in my family has a bachelor's degree, you know? Like, it's just, like, not where I come from. And then to do it in my mid-30s was just life-changing. And now I have a career where I can can be artistic still as a graphic designer, and I love what I do, but I also can now pay the bills, you know? And it's like really, and I can also take care of my son, and in a way that I would never be able to do if I had to work in a different industry, because now I get to work from home doing the job that I love, you know? It's just like crazy how life, you know, throws you lemons, and now because I have a relationship with God and this program, I get to make lemonade with it, you know? And that's what this my sponsor Arisa has taught me, you know, like it's not about it always being so easy and like perfect and like, you know, like there's a lot of struggle, you know. And I'll just tell you, like, you know, another thing that has, you know, it's been a real rough couple of years. I ended up having my first son last year. He was born, and he ended up living for 2 weeks, and he ended up passing away. After 2 weeks, he ended up getting sick while he was in the NICU. He was born early, and he got out a blood infection, and it ended his life. You know, he couldn't survive it. It was really, really tragic. It was very, very hard and very, very tragic and painful. And I had to make a choice then whether I was gonna, you know, have a second step proposition, like either God is everything or God is nothing. And my sponsor got to help me, you know, continue on this path, because I would never have been able to survive that pain if it wasn't for the people in this room and for this program, because I have experienced a lot of loss, but I have never been through anything like that. And for me and my husband to be able to continue to show others how they can stay sober under any and all conditions is like what I get to do with that today. And like, it's been insane, because I was so scared to try and have another baby. Like, I really didn't know what that was going to look like, but I knew it was bigger than me. It was something deeper inside of me. Like, I was either going to trust and rely upon God to walk through this fear, because I didn't want to sit on the sidelines of my life and regret not having the baby if that was what was in my heart of hearts, you know, like, because I could have taken that traumatic moment and been like, you know what, I wasn't supposed to have the kid, you know, I'm the forgotten stepchild, of course this was going to happen to me. Or I could have, you know, persevered through that pain and see what else is on the other side of it by trusting God and continuing to work this program one day at a time. And my son that I have today, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, but right now I get to enjoy this beautiful boy. He is so precious. Like, he is an unbelievable gift in my life. And I can't even believe I get to be his mother, you know? And I get to be sober today, and I'm hoping that I can continue to show him a way of life too that can help him overcome any obstacle it's going to throw him by relying and trusting upon something way bigger than him, whatever he chooses to believe in. But that is what I get to show him today, that life is going to happen to us all. No one escapes life. Like, life can be really difficult, but life can be really beautiful at the same time. And so this is why I'm really passionate about AA, and I never want to go back to where I came from. And so I really do work hard at staying in the middle of this. I sponsor women. I have sponsees that have sponsees. I started a meeting in my area where I live, which is about 45 minutes north of here. And it's in Danvers. It's called the Fourth Dimension Group. It meets actually on Wednesday nights. And it's a gift to come here, regardless if it's my home group or not, to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope, because this is something I get to do today. And like, you know, I will never be able to give back to Beacon Group what it has so given to me, especially with the message of AA. And I have been able to now learn what the Beacon Group has taught me and to bring that message up there where it's dark. You know, there's a lot of meetings up there that don't have the solution. They really think that all you have to do is shoot for midnight. And that's fine. You know, that works for a lot of people, but for the ones that it didn't work for, like me, I started this meeting so that I can also help other people find a solution. You know, like, it's been a big gift in my life as well. And there's about 40 or 50 people that come every week, and there's a lot of interest in that area. Like, they really, really are getting something out of the big book, and they're learning about the service structure above the group level, because we have a GSR and we practice the 36 principles, and we have, you know, know, service positions available for the newcomer. And I have everything I have learned about the way that I conduct that meeting. And it's not just me. I have a lot of help now. I have delegated a lot of the responsibility, and I actually got to have a maternity leave with my child, and the meeting got to operate regardless if I was there or not. And the meeting is strong, just as strong as its group members, just like this meeting, you know? And like, I can't give back. I can never give AA back enough of what it has given to me. And if you are struggling or new and you haven't really tried the 12 steps, like, I mean, you might want to try it. You just might, you know? And like, now I just know that like, there is a God in my life that can't wait to see what I'm going to do next. And that God is available to you too. So thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you, Andrea. Now we have